if you turn to Psalms 32, verse 2, the title of today's sermon comes from Psalms 32, verse 2. Psalms 32, 2 says, "Blessed is the man unto whom the Lord imputes not iniquity, and in whose spirit there is no guile." In whose spirit there is no guile. The title of the sermon would be, "Blessed is the man who has no guile." You know, guile isn't really a word we use these days. I don't know about you. Do you use the word guile in your everyday sentence? How hath thou been doing it today? Hath thou guile present within? Dilly dilly. You know, we don't actually talk like this. We don't use the word guile in our speech today, do we? So it's not a common word. So what does actually guile mean, and what does that actually have to do with anything? If you look at the word that's listed here in the Hebrew, guile means a number of things. It means deceit or acting deceitfully or treacherously or with a false pretense and things like that. And a lot of times the word in, you look at a modern translation, no longer uses the word guile, and they've changed it to the word deceit, probably one of the closest things. And it's saying, blessed in whose spirit there is no guile. It's not just saying, hey, you know, it's present in the life, it's present maybe in some words. It's saying, blessed in whose spirit. That means your entire being of who you are, how you operate, how you think, how you feel, how you interact with others, how you interact with yourself, how you talk to other people, your entire being, your entire presence. There is no guile. This is what God is actually looking for. And guile has to do, you know, being deceitful, or, you know, being tricky and operating in a way that's like that, or being really cunning, being kind of manipulative. All of these types of things are working and operating out of guile. And God says, blessed is one whose spirit has none of this in it. None of this in it. In fact, turn over to John 1. John 1, verse 43 is a really interesting story where Christ talks about this topic. John 1, verse 43. John 1, 43. This is the story of Nathanael. It says, "The following day, Jesus wanted to go to Galilee, and he found Philip, and he said to him, 'Follow me.' And now Philip was from Bethsaida, the city of Andrew and Peter. And then Philip found Nathanael and said to him, 'We have found him of whom Moses in the law and also prophets wrote, Jesus of Nazareth, the son of Joseph.' And Nathanael said to him, 'Can anything good come out of Nazareth?' And Philip said to him, 'Come and see.'" Right, so we have this Philip and Nathanael had obviously been reading the scriptures. They said, you know, Moses, the law, they've been reading the prophets, and they were reading of this Jesus of Nazareth, the Messiah to come. And they saw that there. And they said, "Look, we found who we've been reading about." And so, verse 47, Jesus saw Nathanael coming towards him. He sees this guy walking, and he says to him, "Behold, an Israelite indeed, in whom is no deceit or is no guile." If you look at the King James Version, it says, "An Israel indeed, in whom is no guile." And that word there is very similar to what's in the Hebrew as well. Deceit, it's translated to bait people, to act out of decoying, you know, subtlety, craftiness. If you look at the meaning of the word, it's all of those types of things. And a lot of the Israelites in the day would kind of operate like that. They would be crafty, they'd be deceitful, they'd be manipulative, they'd be, you know, one thing that you just didn't quite know. And that's called what Christ calls deceit or guile. But he says this guy, Nathanael, walking towards him, here's an Israel, and in him is no guile. Look at this person, there's no guile. And how could he see that? Right? He saw someone who was honest with himself. The title of the song was, you know, "If I'm Honest." And the idea of no guile is you being honest with yourself completely through and through. Top, bottom, left, or right. In your spirit, there is no trickiness, cunningness, no deceit, nothing like that. No subtlety, no tricks, or playing tricks on people, or manipulating, or pushing, or trying to get people to do things like that. He says, here's a person with integrity, complete honesty with himself. Wide open book. And you can hear him say that. He's like, well, can anything good come from Nazareth? He's not mincing his words. He's not being negative. He's just saying, he's just completely an open book of what he's saying. But Nathanael says in the next verse to him, he says, how do you know me? How? How can you know me? Right? And this is an important point to understand here, is that Christ and God can spot guile and deceit instantly. Right? They can spot it instantly. And how? Why is that the case? Let me just quote 1 Peter 2:22. Talking of Christ, he says, who committed no sin, nor was guile found in his mouth. Christ as a being here on earth, one of the defining characteristics of who he was is that he himself had no guile, no deceit in his mouth. Anything that he said was very clear. Anything he said was not to manipulate. Anything he said was very straightforward. Otherwise, he didn't say it. He didn't have the trickery. Now, the people of the day, you remember, and we'll look at one example later, had a lot of trickery with the words that they said, a lot of ways that they tried to manipulate and be cunning and deceitful and things like that. But the point is that Christ and our God themselves have no guile. They don't speak it, they don't think it, they don't stay around it, they aren't anything about that. And that point is that when you do have it to a place where your character has no guile, you can easily spot guile or not guile. You have to have guile removed out of you and not live that way for you to be able to spot it. If not, you'll not necessarily see it, or it'll be confusing, or it'll feel, or you'll dip into it yourselves. And so Christ can see this guy straight off and say, I see a person who has no guile. They recognize that this person has no guile. Now, this is the interesting part. So do you and I have guile? Maybe if you stop and examine yourself and thought about that, you'd say, oh, maybe sometimes. There's only a couple people who know you have guile. One is possibly you. Who's the other? God already knows. God knows exactly how you act and think and operate. Just as he looked at Nathanael here and said, hey, he has no guile, he can look at you and instantly say, I don't know. There's a little bit of a mixture here. There's a little bit of stuff going on here. God knows it instantly. And here's the important point to know. You and I can trick everyone else. But this is important to know that right this very second, if you walk before God, he could tell you, I know exactly how you are. And I'm waiting for you to catch up with this. I'm waiting for you to realize it and you to realize this is an important thing to focus on and to think about and to get straight. And God will operate with us in our lives until we squeeze this out, until it gets squeezed out of us. And I'll show you an example of that later, how this works, because it's super important. This is one of those things that God is looking for. If you want some things to focus on in life, to say, what should I be doing now? But when we're heading to the kingdom later, what should I be focusing on now? This is one of those things to examine yourself about and say, do I have this in my spirit at all? Do I operate like this in any single way, shape, or form? Do I smell or sniff? Can somebody say, you, that was a little, you know, odd? Anything like that. This is something for us to ask ourselves. God knows right this second. He knows if you have guile or not, and he'll take you through life until it gets pushed out. And let's see that in just a bit. Now, let's go back to the back where we were, talking about Nathanael. So back in John 1, you should still be there. So John 1, he said, how did you know me? And Jesus answered, he said to him, verse 48, before Philip called you, you were under the fig tree. I saw you. So there's an exchange happening here that's actually quite meaningful. Nathanael answered him, said, Rabbi, you're the Son of God. You're the King of Israel. He is saying to Nathanael, I know where you were and what you were doing under that tree. It's obviously a thing that nobody else could have known. It wasn't just like there's a bunch of people walking by and he said, oh, you are one of the 10 people who saw me. This is a private moment of him under the tree and Christ calls it out. So he says, you must be a prophet if you saw that. And Jesus answered and said, because I say to you, I saw you under the fig tree, do you believe me? You will see greater things than these. And he said to him, most assuredly, I say to you, hereafter you shall see heaven open and the angels of God ascending and descending upon the Son of Man. Now, this dialogue and exchange is not by accident. This dialogue and exchange is very deliberate because that is a reference to something. What do you think Nathanael was doing? That he's actually sitting under the tree reading something. And what do you think he was reading? if you look at how this was unfolded. That right there, this verse 51, talking about heaven open, angels ascending and descending. What is that a reference to? You probably read a story or heard of a story of this before, right? So what he's saying is, I actually saw you under the fig tree, nobody else would have, and I also know what you were reading. And he made reference to it. And this is where Nathanael was like, wow, you must be the Son of God if you know that. What he was referring to was he was studying a passage of Scripture in the Old Testament. Let's turn back to, hold your place in John, but turn back to Genesis 28. Actually, don't hold your place in John. We'll just keep moving forward. Genesis 28, verse 10. What he's referring to is this passage of Scripture. So Genesis 28, verse 10. It says, now Jacob went out from Beersheba and went towards Haran. So he came to a certain place and stayed there all night, and because the sun had set. And he took one of the stones of that place and he put it at his head, and he lay down in the place to sleep. Then he dreamed, and behold, a ladder was set up on the earth, and its top reached down to heaven. And there the angels of God were ascending and descending upon it. And if you look at any of how this unfolded, this was a very deliberate noticing Christ of him reading a scripture, and he referenced it in this passage. And that's what he says to him. And this is why Nathanael says, wow, that's amazing. You knew this. And what passage of scripture he's reading was about a man named Jacob. And this is a vision that he had. Now, what's interesting is he's also referencing Jacob. Because what was Jacob like? What kind of a guy was Jacob? We'll go through that in a second. But so Nathanael's sitting there reading a passage of scriptures about a guy who was very much full of guile and deceit. This is what he's reading, and he's taking it to heart, and he's saying, look, I'm reading through the life of Jacob, and I see it. And so Christ makes reference, says, hey, you know, here's a guy who has no guile. You're reading about a guy who does. Here's a man who doesn't. And I know what you're reading. And I showed him a vision, and I will show you one as well. It's just that kind of a paraphrase of what he's saying. So this whole exchange is very deliberate about what Christ is saying to Nathanael. And he's calling reference back to this set of scriptures. So it's very educational to understand when we look at this context. There's so much packed in just a few verses about not having guile, what Nathanael's reading, what Christ is calling out, and the example that he was pointing back to is the example of Jacob. So it's worth actually going through a few of those things just to see this. And Christ said, I was the one who revealed that to Jacob. He also says, I was the one who was involved in his life, as I will be the one to reveal it to you. And I am the one involved in your life. And you can see this whole exchange was on purpose like that. So what type of a person was Jacob? Let's just kind of breeze through some of the things here. Turn back to Genesis 25, 29. We'll start there. Read a few examples. A lot of these should be familiar to us. But Genesis 25, verse 29. This is Jacob and his brother Esau. It says, now Jacob cooked a stew, and Esau came in from the field, and he was weary. And Esau said to Jacob, please feed me with some of that red stew, for I am weary. And therefore his name was called Edom. But Jacob said, sell me your birthright as of this day. And Esau said, look, I'm about to die. Who cares about that thing? And Jacob said, swear to me as of this day. And so he swore to him, and he sold his birthright. And Jacob gave Esau bread and stew of lentils, and ate and drank, and went his way, etc. So the type of person Jacob was is very cunning. And you see this from the start throughout all he does. He's very cunning and he's very kind of manipulative. Oh, I'm going to take advantage of you while you're starving. Guess what? You sell me your birthright, I'll give you this food, this little bowl of lentils. And he kind of manipulated, and he, you know, Esau obviously despised it, like it says, but he kind of manipulated him into this. Now go down to Genesis 27, verse 2. So this is where their dad is dying. It says, behold, now I am old. I do not know the day of my death. Now, therefore, please take your weapon, your quiver, and your bow, and go out to the field and hunt game for me. So his brother Esau was a hunter. He was just a guy, like they said, kind of a mild man who stayed in the tents with his mama. That's what Jacob was. And so Esau's this big, you know, burly hunter, and he was quite hairy. And so his dad said, hey, go out before I die. You know, go kill me some game. And make me some savory food, you know, such as I love, and bring it to me that I may eat, that my soul may bless you before I die. Now the mom, Rebekah, was listening when Isaac spoke to Esau's son, and Esau went to the field to hunt game and bring it. So Rebekah spoke to Jacob, her son, saying, "Indeed, I've heard your father speak to Esau, your brother, saying, 'Bring me game, make me savory food, that I may eat it and bless you. Now therefore, my son, obey my voice, according to what I command you. Go now to the flock and bring me from there two choice kids of goats, and I will make savory food from them for your father, such as he loves. Then you should take it to your father, that he may eat it, that he may bless you before his death.' And Jacob said to Rebekah, his mother, 'Look, Esau, my brother, is a hairy man, and I'm a smooth-skinned man. Perhaps my father will feel me, and it shall seem like to be a deceiver to him. And I shall bring a curse on myself and not a blessing.'" That's a great verse right there, right? What does it say? "Blessed is a man in him who is no guile." And guess who is recognizing, in his mind at least, that, you know, if I'm going to act deceptively, then I'm going to bring not blessings, I'm going to bring curses on myself. This is how it works. He, for somehow, could intellectually say that, right? So drop down to verse 42. It says, "The words of Esau, her older son, were told to Rebekah. So she sent and called Jacob and said, 'Surely your brother comforts himself.'" Whoops, sorry. Is that right? Yeah, sorry. Anyway, let me, I'll skip over this, but you know the story. Let me get to Genesis 27:42 in a second. You know the story is that he went into the father, and because he was a hairy man, he took the skin of a, you know, animal, put it over him, and his father was so old, couldn't see, and, you know, his senses weren't there, and he kind of felt him, and he says, "You feel like your brother, but you sound like Jacob." And so he went into the father to trick him, and the father couldn't tell the difference, and so he ended up blessing him, supplanting and taking that. So you can see how Jacob's operating in his life. His mom's helping out with this whole process too, but this is how he is choosing to operate with all of the things. Now, Esau comes back and finds out this happens and is raging mad because Jacob, the younger brother, supplanted him. So that's where down in 27:42, the words of Esau, her oldest son, were told Rebekah. So she called Jacob and said, "Surely your brother Esau comforts himself and by intending to kill you. Now therefore, my son, flee to my brother Laban in Haran and stay with him a few days until your brother's fury turns away, till your brother anger turns away from you and he forgets what you have done to him," right? And so he runs and he flees off. So he goes to Laban's place. So he's tricking, acting deceit. He goes to Laban and then he starts working for Laban. And guess what? Laban himself is a little bit of a tricky person too. And so he says, you know, he finds his daughters and says, "Oh, beautiful daughter." And Laban says, "If you want to marry her, you have to work 7 years." And right. And then Genesis 29, verse 19 says, "Laban said, 'It's better that I give her to you than I should give her to another man. Stay with me. So come work.' Jacob served him 7 years for Rachel, and they seemed only a few days to him because he loved her." Right. And then at the end of that time, you know, he says, "Oh, there's another one. We'll work another 7 years." And so what kept happening here, back and forth, is that Jacob operated out of deceit, and then Laban operated back at him this way. And you'll see that this process went on for a lot of years, a long period of time, right? And then go down to Genesis 30, verse 25. "So it came to pass that Rachel had borne Joseph. Then Jacob said to Laban, 'Look, send me away, that I may go to my own place and my country. Give me my wives and children, whom I have served you. Let me go, for you know my service which I have done for you.'" Right? So he's saying, "Look, I keep serving you. I keep getting my wives. I've got all my stuff. Just let me go now." And Jacob said to him, "You know I have served you and how your livestock has been with me." Oops, sorry. 27 says, "Please stay." He says, "I have learned by experience that the Lord blessed me for your sake." And then he said, "Name your wages and I will give it." In 29, Jacob said, "You know I have served you and how your livestock has been with me. For what you have I came was little and it's increased to a great amount. The Lord has blessed you since my coming. And now what shall I also provide for my own house?" So he said, "What shall I give you?" And Jacob said, "Well, you don't have to give me anything. If you do this for me, I'll again feed and keep your flocks. Let me just..." I mean, this is kind of funny because he still is doing the same stuff. "Let me pass through your flocks today. Let me remove from there all the speckled and the spotted sheep and all the brown ones among the lambs and the spotted and the speckled among the goats. Those will be my wages," right? "Let me just go get the meager outcast of everything and those will be my wages. So my righteousness will answer for me in time to come. when the subject of my wages comes before you. Everyone that is not speckled and spotted among the goats and the brown among the lambs will be considered stolen if it's with me. And Laban said, oh, that it were according to your word. So he removed that day the male goats that were speckled and spotted, all the female goats that were speckled and spotted, everyone that had some white in it, and all the brown ones among the lambs. And he gave them into the hands of his sons. Then he put 3 days' journey between himself and Jacob fed the rest of Laban's flocks. Now, verse 37. Jacob took for himself rods of green poplar and the almond and chestnut trees, peeled white strips in them, and exposed the white which was in the rods. And the rods which he had peeled he set before the flocks in the gutters, in the watering troughs where the flocks came to drink, so that they should conceive when they came to drink. So the flocks conceived before the rods, and the flocks brought forth streaked, speckled, and spotted. Then Jacob separated the lambs and made their flocks face forward toward the streaked and all the brown of the flock of Laban. But he put his own flocks by themselves and did not put them with Laban's flocks. And it came to pass, whenever the stronger livestock conceived, that Jacob placed the rod before the eyes of the livestock in the gutters, that they might conceive among the rods. But when the flocks were feeble, he did not put them in. So the feebler were Laban's and the stronger were Jacob's. Thus the man became exceedingly prosperous and had large flocks, female and male servants, and camels and donkeys. So to summarize what he was doing is he knew what he was doing. Right? The way he stripped the wood and things and he made them come in and conceive so that they would have additional livestock born, he saw on purpose deliberately the strong ones and he steered them to it. And if I would summarize this, and he steered the weak ones over to Laban so that his multiplied exceedingly strong, Laban's did not. So what he's doing here, he said originally what he was saying to him is like, I won't take any of the premium ones. You have all of those. I will take all the weak ones. Right? And Laban's like, wow, this is amazing. And he says, look, you'll know I'm righteous and I gave up everything. But when he goes through this process, he makes it happen. He manipulates it to where he ends up with all the strong ones after they conceive, is basically what happened. So he's still tricking him. He's still tricking Laban, is what he's doing. Right? So this goes back and forth. And what you find is Jacob would be deceitful. Laban would come back and trick Jacob. Jacob would go do something else. Laban would come back and trick Jacob. This went on for years and years and years and years and years. And you get to Genesis 31, verse 4, and Jacob sent and called Rachel and Leah to the field to his flock, and he said to them, look, I see your father's countenance. It's not favorable to me as before, but the God of my father has been with me, and you know that with all my might I have served your father. Yet your father has deceived me and changed my wages 10 times. But God did not allow him to hurt me. If he said thus, the speckled be your wages, then all the flocks before speckled. And if he says thus, the streaked be your wages, then all the flocks before streaked. So God has taken away the livestock of your father and given them to me. So it's a very interesting story here. Because this is a guy that deals deceitfully. God's still blessing him. But at the same time, the thing that he's going through here is excruciatingly hard and long. And he's getting tricked. He's getting duped. He's getting played now, is what's happening. And it takes him these getting your wages changed 10 times, getting promised one daughter, giving the other, having to work 7 years, get the other daughter, doing this, doing, you know, all of these changes and swaps. As you see that God was blessing him in the flocks, but God was still working with Jacob to get this squeezed out of him. And it took this whole time. He didn't just give him some big lecture. He ran him through a big process in his life. And Laban comes after him now as he starts to go, you know. And can you see what the operating out of deceit and guile causes? You see how the interactions end up happening with other people. Laban's mad at him. His brother was chasing him. Everybody's mad at this guy, right, when they realize how duped they were or played that they were doing. And then it gets played back. So Jacob's life's a good example. Somebody who dealt treacherously, God still can bless them, but he also took them through the longest process to where he lost and got played himself. If you deal in deceit and treachery or guile, you will have it done back to you, and you won't necessarily be able to get out of it. You see, it's very important to realize that it should not be part of us at all. Our spirit should have nothing like this in it. We shouldn't operate like this, no matter if other people are operating like this. No matter if everybody else is deceitful and tricky and political and stabs you behind the back and everything else, we don't operate like that. It shouldn't be part of our spirit. Well, we have to have wisdom in this world. You do have to have wisdom in this world, but you can't operate out of deceit, guile, and those type of things in life. So we get to the end of Jacob's life, and we find this kind of wrapped up, not the end, but way down the line, years and years later, Genesis 32. Let's read this part. Genesis 32, verse 22. Genesis 22, verse 32. It's only at this point, at the end of his life, God says, no, I think we've got this. So Genesis 32, verse 22 says, he arose that night and he took his two wives, his two female servants, and his 11 sons and crossed over the ford of Jabbok. He took them, sent them over the brook, and sent them over what he had. And then Jacob was left alone, and a man wrestled with him until the breaking of day. Now when he saw that he did not prevail against him, he touched the socket of his hip, and the socket of Jacob's hip was out of joint as he wrestled with him. And he said, let me go, for the day breaks. But he said, I will not let you go unless you bless me. So he said to him, what's your name? And he said, Jacob. And he said, your name shall no longer be called Jacob, but Israel. For you have struggled with God and with men and have prevailed. Then Jacob asked him, say, tell me your name, I pray. He says, why do you ask that? And he blessed him there. So Jacob called the name of the place Peniel, for I've seen God face to face. My life is preserved. Right? And this is where we kind of find that after all of that long ordeal, that he says, look, you've struggled on this. You've struggled with God and man, but you've struggled with this. But we're at a place where you prevailed, or you're overcoming this now, basically. That's part of what he's saying in all of this, that you've overcome this. You've been struggling for years with Laban, your brother, with all these other things, but now you've prevailed. And you know what? You're no longer that person. I'm going to change your name. You're a new person. You're this person now. And you can see, though, how long that took. How long that took? Did God abandon him? No. God's not like that. He works with us over long periods of time. And he worked with Jacob that way. And he squeezed this out of him by letting what he did to other people happen to him. And this is an interesting thing, because Jacob was probably frustrated like crazy in here. Why can't I just get out of here? And he's changed my way just 10 times, and all this stuff has happened to me, and it's not fair. Well, he got a dose of how he was. He got it done to him what he did to other people. And you see his approach later now. He's less, you know, when his brother comes out to meet him, he's less trying to trick him, and he's way more trying to be honest. Sorry, I shouldn't have, and you can deal with me now as you want, etc. He acted with wisdom to pacify him, but he's no longer trying to just trick him out of everything. And his brother calmed down a bit. He calmed him down. You know why? Because he wasn't dealing with deceit and guile anymore. He was trying to be honest with himself and with his brother now. There's problems to pay because of what he's done in the past, but you can see the different interactions. When you deal with deceit and guile, we only cause and inflame things. We only cause anger. We only cause a lot of things to escalate. But when we deal with purity and honesty in ourselves and with others, things de-escalate. They go down. They don't go up. So Jacob was a different person. Jacob ended up being a different person by the end, and God knew that and recognized it. So you can see that sometimes it may feel like, man, my life feels frustrating. I'm not quite getting there, and that's probably what Jacob felt. It's important to know how God works with us. He may see something like that. I'm not saying that's what it is, but he could see something like he saw with Jacob, and he made him go through such hard circumstances till he had to give up. Like, I concede. I'm wrestling with somebody I did all night long, and I finally have to, you know, give up. But God took him through this process. Long, painful, wrongdoing. Wages changed 10 times. Came out the other end a different man. So you'll see when he says, look, Nathaniel, you're reading about this guy, Jacob. This guy had guile. I gave him a blessing of a vision. I'll give you one. But I also worked with him on his guile. And here is somebody who has read that and taken it to heart and has no guile in them, right? All of that whole story is related to this story and the entire idea of guile and not guile and what he was reading about. So Nathaniel was taking it to heart and obviously working on himself for this. And that's something for us to do too, right? Like I said, your God, if you were to appear before him today, he could tell you exactly what you have for guile or not guile and how you operate. And he's going to take you through life until it gets squeezed out. So this is therefore something for us to start to recognize and just to work on easily, just to say, hey, am I operating like this? You know, guile takes a lot of different forms today. In a Christian life, you could say, yeah, well, I'm not, you know, doing all of that. There's subtleties to guile, too. When it says it doesn't, you know, it shouldn't be in your spirit at all, it means nothing in the thoughts and the approach and the way. And sometimes it can be for us in different ways. Let's turn to Matthew 22:15. Matthew 22:15. Just actually a side note to quote Proverbs 26:26 says, hatred is covered by deceit. What's behind deceit is actual hatred. You don't love another person. You're dealing with it in a manipulative way. It's all about yourself and not about the other person. Matthew 22:15 is a way that we see that kind of deceitful ways come out. So this is a story of the Pharisees. It says, Matthew 22:15, then the Pharisees went and plotted how they might entangle him in talk. And they sent to him the disciples with the Herodians saying, teacher, so what's their motive? To entangle him. How did they approach him? With flattery. Listen to this. Teacher, you know what? We know you're true. We know you teach the way of God and truth, nor do you care about anyone, nor do you regard the person of men. I mean, this is complete flattery. Complete flattery. Tell us, you know, what do you think? Is it lawful to pay taxes? They're coming all innocent. They're coming all in a flattering way to him. And but behind it, if you think about this, is deceit. This is operating in a way where you're covering something up. It sounds great. Sounds great to somebody else. And Jesus knew this. In verse 18, he perceived their wickedness. And he says, why do you test me, you hypocrites? I can see this is, again, your guile is here. Deceit is here. Hypocrisy, you're saying one thing, but you're doing another. I can see that clearly in you. And so he went on and he, you know, acted with wisdom through this. But Christ could see this in every way. And this is one way sometimes it can be. You know, this is one way that people operate at times who can go with flattery, can come and say something to somebody's face, but behind their back, stab them. Right? That is not, that's acting with guile. And these are the type of things we should never do. If you're not going to say something good about somebody, don't say it at all. Don't say anything at all. And it says it shouldn't be in our spirit. Don't even just get rid of the thoughts of thinking it too. And you see here, they did one thing behind his back. And then they said one thing flattery to the other person. You know, there's other ways we kind of phrase things too at times. Turn over to Matthew 26:6. Matthew 26. Saying nice things about people isn't wrong. That's not what I'm saying. It's good to be positive. Very good to be positive. But flattery is different. Flattery is buttering somebody up to get something for yourself. It's a position or it's a thing or whatever it is. It's that type of thing. Matthew 25 is another example. Sorry, Matthew 26:6. It says, and when Jesus was in Bethany at the house of Simon the leper, a woman came to him having an alabaster flask of very costly fragrant oil. She poured it on his head as he sat at the table. But when his disciples saw it, they were indignant, saying, why this waste? For this fragrant oil might have been sold for much and given to the poor. Do you think his disciples actually really cared about the poor in this case? What do you think that they cared about here? Man, that's a lot of money going down the drain right there. Right? They cared about the money. That's all they were, like it says, hey, they saw that it was a lot of money. But we phrase things disingenuously sometimes in religious terms. Oh, you know, like that oil, we could just sell that for the poor, when really they were selfishly wanting it. And this is why it's important that guile to look at it is you to ask the question to yourself is, am I honest with what I'm saying right here? Am I making a reason up that sounds really good and wrapped in religious terms and phrasing and things? Or am I tricking myself with this? And that's the question to ask here. And you see example after example where Christ exposes this and says we shouldn't do any of it like this. Their motivation was the money lost, not the poor. But they made it sound like it was the poor. It's like the red herring. Let's make it sound really religious over here. So it's easy for us in subtlety of growing up or maturing as a Christian to sometimes we have to ask ourselves, am I just saying this way, but I really am want it this way? Am I honest was the song. Am I honest with myself? Are my words lining up with my thoughts or not? Am I honest? Right? And Christ went on and gave them, you know, the real reason that's there. You know, when you have deceit and you have guile, another thing that comes along with it is nothing but betrayal. Nothing but betrayal. Judas Iscariot is a perfect example of this. You know, Luke 22:47. He was very manipulatively tricky. Christ saw through it. He knew that who he was and what he was all about. But Luke 22:47, right? This is Christ getting arrested. It says, while he was still speaking, behold, a multitude, and he who was called Judas, one of the 12, went before them and drew near to Jesus to kiss him. But Jesus said to him, Judas, are you betraying the Son of Man with a kiss? Like, he called him out on this. Because Judas, what is in Judas's heart is rage and anger, and Satan, actually, to come have and kill the Christ. But how did he present himself to the other person? Oh, so good to see you, my friend. Here's a kiss. He's faking this. You know, obviously he's saying, here's whoever I kiss is this, but he's portraying himself to be a great friend. And you can see here again that in a religious type of a gesture, that he is fake and phony in what he's doing here. And he's acting out of deceit and guile in this case. And so Christ, I find it interesting, like I said, Christ had no guile. And when he saw guile, you'll notice every single time he points it out, says, no, look at that, no. And he says this here, are you betraying me with a kiss? Come on, like really. He was betraying the Son of Man here. And you see Judas Iscariot's life was like that. And all I'm bringing out at these points is sometimes the question we need to ask as we mature as Christians and we work on this is, am I doing the same type of thing? I didn't say betraying the Son of Christ or Son of God, but I mean wrapping up a religious sounding thing or flattery or, you know, a very good feeling or point some red herring way that sounds very religious, but I'm not being genuine. Am I just wanting my will for you? What I want for you, and I come and, you know, this is what I want for you. Or am I actually caring about the other person? So it's being honest with ourselves of what our motivations are. Can you want something best for other people? And say it, for sure. That's great. But it's being honest about this. It's lining up your motivations, not acting with guile. And in the church, in the past, I've seen passive aggressiveness is one of the forms that this comes out. Or saying something like, I really just care for you. I want to see the best, but really you just actually want to find out something so you can tell everybody else. Or it's really not for the other person. You have an opinion that you want to make, push on them. And these are the subtle nuances of that. So the question to always come back to is, like the song, am I honest with what I'm saying and what I'm really doing here? So our spirit should have none of this in it. No up, down, left, or right of way of doing this. We should be completely honest. So the antidote, or one of the antidotes, or one big piece of this is found in Matthew 5:37. Matthew 5:37. So what do we do here? Matthew 5:37. Christ gives this principle. It's also in James. It says, let your yes be yes and your no be no, for whatever is more than these is from the evil one, right? And the phrase here isn't, hey, you can only say the words yes or no to people. Otherwise, if you say anything else, it's from the evil one. That's not what it says. It says, if you're going to say yes to something or somebody, it needs to be, that's what you're saying, genuinely yes. If you say no, then it needs to actually genuinely be no. You don't go yes, but you really meant no. You know, so you don't mix what your meaning in the inside is. If you're going to say yes, say it as yes. If you're going to say no, say it as no. Because when you start to mix, when you start to act deceitfully, put out a face but do something else, that is of how the devil works, is what it's saying. That's of the evil one. Like, we should not tread there. Maybe it works to manipulate somebody, but we should never tread there. That's not how we should operate in the slightest bit. Satan's the master of this unclear doublespeak. This is how he talks. This is how he works. Christ is saying, be super clear in your speech. be super clear. If you're talking to somebody, be honest. Don't say, hey, you know, just say, look, hey, I'm struggling with, I'm having a hard time. Can you help me understand it? Like, why you do that? Can you help me understand? I'm struggling with it, to be honest with you. You can be open. It's not a problem. But don't go and say, oh, you know, blah, and then make some big thing that people go like, that feels a little odd. It doesn't feel genuine to me. We should feel very genuine with each other. Your yes is a yes. We speak openly. We are open. We're honest with each other. We're honest with ourselves. That's why we're doing it. So he's saying, let's not play games with our words. Let's not play games with our words, right? turn over to Matthew 27:11. You know, it's okay to not say stuff too. Don't always have to say things. So Matthew 27, verse 11. Now Jesus stood before the governor, and the governor asked him, saying, are you the king of the Jews? And Jesus said, it's as you say. And while he was being accused, the chief of the priests and the elders, he answered nothing. He didn't say anything. But Pilate said to him, do you not hear how many things they testify against you? But he answered him not one word, so that the governor marveled greatly. You know, sometimes you don't have to say anything. They were saying a lot of things that were of lies, of guile, of deceit, and they were trickery in what they were saying, and Christ didn't play in the game at all. He knew what was happening here, but he didn't rebuff it. He didn't come back with some smart quip. He didn't come back with a deceitful, like, you know, hey, Pilate, you know, hey, how are you? How's your family? Have you been working out? Like, you can get me out the back. You know, there's none of that going on. Right? He's not doing, you can see, he doesn't have to rebut every single one of these things. He didn't say anything at all. Guile was never found in Christ's mouth. Not one shade of it was found in how he operated with people. And that's what he's asking of us. Just read two scriptures in closing. 1 Peter 3:8. 1 Peter 3:8. This topic is very important for us to think about as we mature. It's a maturity topic. This is 1 Peter 3:8. Finally, all of you be of one mind, having compassion for one another. Love as brothers. Be tenderhearted. Be courteous. Not returning evil for evil or reviling for reviling, but on the contrary, blessing. Knowing that you are called to this, that you may inherit a blessing. For he who would love life and see good days, let him refrain his tongue from evil, and his lips from speaking deceit or guile. If you would love or have love your life, do you want to see goodness in your days? Then refrain your tongue from evil and don't let them speak anything of deceit. You see how big of a spiritual principle is this? There is a life that's like Nathaniel, where he says you have no guile and you're blessed, and there's a life that's hard like Jacob, where it's getting squeezed out of you. And this says, you want to see good days, do you? Here's something to stop doing. Don't speak evil. Don't speak deceitfully at all, or any nuance of it. It shouldn't be in our spirit at all to speak in this manner in any single way. And what we'll see, turn over to Revelation 4, verse 1, and we'll finish up here. Revelation 14, verse 1. What's the defining characteristic of the 144,000? They made their robes white. It's one, but what else? Revelation 14, verse 1 says, I looked and lo, a lamb stood on the Mount Zion, and with him 144,000, having his father's name written in their foreheads. And I heard a voice from heaven as the voice of many waters, as the voice of a great thunder, and I heard the voice of harpers harping with their harps. And they sung, as it were, a new song before the throne, before the four beasts and the elders, and no man could learn that song but the 144,000, which were redeemed from the earth. These are they which are not defiled with women. That's a defining characteristic. So they're virgins, spiritually virgins. They are they which follow the Lamb wherever he goes. That's another defining characteristic. They were redeemed from among men, being the first fruits unto God and to the Lamb. And in their mouths was found no guile, zero. For they are without fault before the throne of God. one of the three characteristics of the 144,000 that are redeemed from the earth that God says are before the throne is that they don't have guile. There isn't any. Not found. Not found here. Not manipulative flattery. Not buttering up somebody but doing something else. Not just trying to get your own way. But there is no guile. There is no deceit. So the question we have to ask when we look at this, am I acting more like Jacob? Well, guess what your life is going to be like? It's going to be like Jacob's. You're going to have some hard things to go through to get squeezed out. Doesn't mean you don't have any blessings, like I said, but Jacob had all these twists and turns and it was really difficult. Am I acting more like Jacob? Your life will be more like Jacob. Am I acting with purity like Nathaniel? Then I will be blessed. I will have blessed life that way. God knows how you are right now. God knows how you are. Will you be willing to admit how you are and work on it is all the question is. So as the song said, am I honest?